You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Crisis standards of care have once again been deactivated in Idaho. As of Tuesday afternoon, Idaho health and welfare officials said the Omicron wave is starting to slow, but hospitals are still facing large numbers of severely ill patients. Joining us today are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, and Dr. Cassie Wyatt, an infectious disease physician with training in epidemiology, who works at Sawtooth Epidemiology and is also a partner with St. Alphonsus. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today.
Hi, Gemma.
Hi, thank you.
And Dr. Wyatt, thank you. This is your first time on our medical expert roundtable, so we really appreciate a new voice. So good to have you with us.
Thanks
for having me. So, Dr. Pate, can we just start with where we are in terms of Omicron? As I mentioned at the top of the program, these standards of care, these crisis standards of care, have been deactivated. However, we still have a high positivity rate. And as I mentioned, hospitals still have quite a few patients.
Yeah, so certainly we're not out of the woods yet, but obviously things are much better. So we did hit our peak. Our cases are on their way down. But I think it's important for everybody to realize that the cases in Idaho are still extremely high. So just to give a frame of reference, there's a couple of ways, well, there's many ways to look at what is the degree of transmission out there. One is to look at the testing positivity, which we've talked about a lot of times. And as your listeners remember, we ideally would like to see that below 5%. The last time I checked the state site, I think it was around 25%. So we're still quite high, much higher than we would want to be. The other thing, what I look at is our 7-day moving average of daily new cases per 100,000 people. And generally, you get into accelerated community spread when that number is over 10. And that number, when I looked at it the last time, was about 47 in Idaho. It's probably actually higher than that because of the backlog of cases. So it may be a higher number. But either way you look at this, we still have very, very high levels of spread of this infection in our state, even though it is at the same time, it is improving and it is going down, and we would expect it's going to continue this trajectory. I guess the point being, no one should be letting their guard up at this time.
And Dr. Wyatt, can you talk a bit about how Dr. Pate mentioned these positivity rates? Because I think sometimes, you know, as we are, I mean, I believe last week we were at about a 34% positivity rate, this week 25%. So yes, trending in a good direction. Yet there sometimes seems to be a disconnect with the fact that we are still at a level that it's a pandemic level. I mean, we're not endemic at this point.
So your question being, what would we expect with the trajectory of the degree of positive tests?
Correct. Like where
I think
where
what we're seeing is that the surge spike with Omicron was very steep. The test positivity became the test positivity rate was very high very early. And I think we might see the same thing as we start to de-escalate down the other side of that peak. We might see the test positivity rate go down quicker than we'd seen with some of the other variants. That being said, the rate is still quite high, but keep in mind that the test positivity rate also simply means that of all the people who present with symptoms that may be COVID, what percentage of those are actually testing positive for COVID? Mm. So there may still be other, you know, people in the community who are positive who aren't, you know, presenting to get a test. There's still a little bit of a backlog with some of the tests. So the rate may even be higher than what we're really seeing in the statistics that we presented today.
And with that said, there is a lot going on in regards to mask wearing, especially as we see these numbers trending down. And Dr. Pate, the Boise School District made a decision earlier this week to approve a mask optional plan. With that said, they proposed the plan to take effect March 28th. That is after spring break. So yet we know of other districts where it's been mask optional for a while. There's no more contact tracing, anything like that. Your thoughts on this mask optional plan for the Boise School District, but waiting for, about another 5 to 6 weeks?
Yeah, well, you know, I have a lot of different thoughts on this, as you're probably not surprised to hear, given our talks over the last couple of years. First of all, I'm grateful that Boise School District didn't eliminate the requirement for masks today. As we've just been talking about, the disease levels are still extremely high. And I just want to reemphasize, even for all of those who rightly point out that most children do fine, it appears, with this infection. Most children do not end up in the hospital. Most children do not die if they get infected. But nevertheless, there are some bad things that happen to some of these kids. And the bigger problem is that they take this infection home and they infect older adults who are not vaccinated or do have vulnerabilities. And they are the ones that end up in our hospitals. So that's why we still have to protect kids, even if you're not worried about the kids themselves. Now, so I applaud them for that. And I have applauded the Boise School District for being more thoughtful than some. On the other hand, I am a little befuddled about this magical date, setting a date in March and saying that's when it'll end. I don't think Dr. Wyatt or I can predict what the disease level transmission will be at that time, a month from now. I don't think either one of us can tell you, you know, are we going to be dealing with a new surge, a new variant, whatever. So it seems strange to me to do this by picking dates rather than setting some guidelines. When the disease transmission is below this level, then we don't need to wear masks in the school. When it is higher than this level, then everybody needs to wear masks. That would make a lot more sense to me. With that said, I think just being pragmatic and understanding that people are just done with this, and that it is very hard to be a board member right now and advocate for masks. I think that, you know, one of my other criticisms of school boards is they just haven't used a lot of good governance practices. And I'm not talking about Boise School District here, but, you know, one thing that they can do is if they feel like, okay, you know, there's just no way that we can continue masks, we've got to do something else. Well, then why not call in experts like Dr. Wyatt, like others, and say, look, tell us what is the next best thing we can do to protect these children, decrease the transmission in our schools, keep our teachers in school, keep our students in school, because there are other options. There's other things we can talk about, including there could be some quite effective testing strategies that could be done in place of masks. So I think, you know, this approaching the decision as, well, the decision is, are we going to have masks or no masks? Well, you know, that's not a really good framework for handling this. It's the question of what are going to be your mitigation strategies. And if there's some we have to take off the table, then let's look at some of the others. So a long answer to your question, but that's kind of my reaction.
Mm-hmm. No, I think those are good points. And Dr. Wyatt, I mean, your thoughts in regards to what we're seeing in schools, And the fact that, look, I mean, I think everyone wants to try to get to a point where this isn't required. With that said, I mean, is it better to pick, you know, a date that frankly maybe will be at a below 5% positivity rate? Or, as Dr. Pate said, you know, saying we'll wait until we get to, you know, X percent of positivity rates?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is a complex issue that we are all aware without a perfect answer. Ideally, would be in a position that we just had a system that was facile, like Dr. Pate pointed out, that, you know, once the transmission rate is low enough in the community, then we don't wear our masks. When it goes above this, then we wear our masks, then just have everybody would be in agreement with this plan. But as we've seen through that just seems like that's not a realistic possibility. And so with the goal of keeping the students healthy in school, keeping the teachers healthy in school, schools open, I think one thing that we can all say is, you know, people are exhausted from the masks, but we are moving to a point that where we weren't 2 years ago, right? We have very effective vaccines at preventing severe hospitalization and illness. We have new novel therapies to provide to our immunocompromised patients who may not mount a response to the vaccine. You know, all school-age children now qualify for a vaccine. We have new antiviral medications that we're ramping up production. So we're in a different place now than we were previously. And so maybe now is the time to say, let's start, you know, thinking about removing the masks, because we have other ways to protect the vulnerable individuals who were hit so hard with COVID early on. So,
and before we take a break, Dr. Pate, we talked about this last week because there was some good news coming out in regards to the COVID vaccine for children under 5. But after our conversation a couple of days later, we now know that this might take longer than expected. Pfizer Biotech postponed its application to the FDA, saying that they believe that 3 doses may provide a higher level of protection in this particular age group. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because school-age children, thank goodness, can all have the option to be vaccinated, but we have a huge number of children under the age of 5 who cannot be.
Yes. And, you know, the other aspect to this, Gemma, is that if you do look at children and divide them up into little subgroups by age, it is these younger children that disproportionately have the more severe outcomes. And so I know there were a lot of parents and grandparents, including me, disappointed at the news. So, you know, here's several things. Number one, first of all, I'm grateful that the FDA and frankly, I've not been a big fan of a lot of the pharmaceutical companies, but even they have exercised a lot of responsibility, I think, during this health emergency. But I think we can be very appreciative that the FDA isn't rushing into things, wants to be very careful, doesn't want to give the public a reason not to trust their approval process. With that in mind, though, this was a very unusual situation. First of all, we don't do a lot of these emergency use authorizations outside of a situation like this. And second of all, it's pretty unusual to bring a drug for review or a vaccine for review when you say, well, we're still going to need more data. We're going to need this third shot for especially the older, the 2 to 4 age group. That's unusual. I was disappointed. I could understand waiting for the third dose data. I wish we could have gone ahead and done 0 to 2 because unlike the 2 to 4, they did actually show a very good response, much like teenagers and young adults. But on the other hand, that probably would have confused the public. That might have further contributed to some of the misinformation going on that out there, some of the mistrust. So probably in the long run, it is a good idea just to be extra cautious, but no doubt it is a disappointment. The decision was made a little bit easier by the fact of what we've been talking about, that the Omicron surge is coming down and coming down fast. And so perhaps we can buy some more time to have better and more complete data.
We have been getting quite a few questions about vaccine boosters, and we've gotten a couple of emails. A couple of voicemails rather. So let's take a listen.
When will those of us who have received a booster in the fall of 2021 likely need an additional booster in 2022?
And let's listen to this voicemail.
Where do things stand regarding a second booster?
So, Dr. Pei, can we talk about that? We know right now that if you are immunocompromised, you are available for that second booster. But a lot of people wondering if they need to get that second booster, in particular with some research coming out saying that first booster, the effectiveness of it starts to wane after, I believe it's 3 to 4 months.
Yeah, you know, this is a tough issue because we still don't have a great definition for what we call the correlates of immunity. In other words, you know, what tests could I do on you, Gemma, to determine if you are immune? We rely on checking for antibodies, but we know antibodies don't tell the whole story. And tests of other things are quite complicated, quite time consuming, and quite expensive. So we don't really have a good way to measure that. So one of the other ways we do that is we just look at the populations of people that have been boosted. And then we see, do we start seeing a lot of them end up very ill in the hospital or dying? And we hadn't really seen much of that. It seems that people that are boosted, while certainly we're seeing breakthrough infections, most of those people are not getting severely ill. They're not getting hospitalized and they're not dying from COVID. We just had a study come in that has looked at this issue across 10 states in the United States. From last August to this January. And they did see that the vaccine effectiveness of the booster for protecting against hospitalization decreased by the fourth month from about 91% after the couple months after the booster down to about 78% by the fourth month. So there is some indication that, you know, they're, I mean, 78% is still pretty good. It's just not as high as we would have liked or we've had before. So there is some thought that in the upcoming months, the CDC and the FDA will probably be looking at this question and looking at whether a booster is indicated. The problem with this study was that unfortunately they included people that were immunocompromised. And we know those people that are immunocompromised don't mount a very good response after just 3 shots. So they may be making the data look worse than it really is. And so I think the FDA and the CDC will be studying this. I wouldn't be surprised if in the upcoming months we hear something about another recommended booster, but I certainly don't believe there's any reason to believe that's imminent. And I think those people who are not boosted should get boosted. And those people that are boosted should still feel pretty confident about the current level of protection.
Dr. Wyatt, Kyle writes in, he says, I came home with COVID for my birthday present. Yay. I soon gave it to my wife who is still struggling to recover. So my question is this: even though in theory we cannot re-catch COVID for a while, is it possible for us to spread the virus?
So you should only be able to spread the virus if you are either actively infected or maybe have asymptomatic COVID. Once you've fully recovered from the virus, so your symptoms are fully resolved, and then we usually recommend a 10-day isolation time from the onset of symptoms. After that has passed, it's very unlikely that you're still going to be contagious to be able to spread the virus to other individuals.
Dr. Pate, Joe from Boise wrote in saying, what does it mean when they say vaccines are currently 83% effective in preventing hospitalizations or something to that effect, that for every 100 vaccinated people that can contract the Omicron variant, does that mean that 17 of them would end up in the hospital? That seems extraordinarily high.
Yeah, so it's a good question. It's complicated. First of all, when people talk about vaccine effectiveness, you need to know effectiveness against what? And so are we talking about against infection? Are we talking about against severe illness? Are we talking about hospitalization? Because it's all going to be different. It also is going to depend on when was that data determined? Because if we determine vaccine effectiveness, let's say, for example, do that study during Delta, but now we're in Omicron, that vaccine effectiveness data will be less meaningful. So in this listener's question, he's asking about vaccine effectiveness of hospitalization. So the way they do this is they look at two groups of people in their study, and they'll take a group that does get the booster, and then they'll take a group that doesn't have the booster. And then they will follow them for some period of time, and then they will see of those two groups, when somebody gets infected, how often do they end up being hospitalized? So the vaccine effectiveness percentage that they speak of is actually comparing the study group to the control group, and it's the ratio is determined from that, not in the general population.
Okay. Dr. Wyatt, Andrew just sent this in, and he says, what are the benchmarks for transitioning to treating COVID as endemic, as we do the flu, and allowing healthy vaccinated citizens to go back to living normally?
Yeah, so I think that most physicians and people in the medical community, we're pretty comfortable saying that this is already probably endemic, but we don't really know what that looks like yet because it hasn't reached a steady state in our community and in our country. And so we don't know what that steady state is going to look like. And that's going to probably depend when we come down from the Omicron surge and whether we have another variant that surges. And once we start to learn, are we going to have new variants emerge, you know, annually, semi-annually, every couple of years, like we do with influenza? We just don't know the answer to that yet. And so what I would say is that our real goal here is to, you know, try to hope that this gets to a point that it's just a very low level percolation within our community. And it may have seasonal ebb and flow, kind of like influenza, things that we don't fully understand yet. I think you would be hard pressed to find many physicians at this point or people in the medical community who would say that this is going to go away. And the fact that it's, you know, here, we're going to just consider it to be endemic to some degree. So. Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Wyatt, with that said, I mean, do you think that there are, you know, when we hear this term back to normal, you know, I personally always think like, well, I mean, we're 2 years into this. I mean, in a way, this is our normal, right? And do you think that certain practices may stay in place moving forward? I mean, I think about, you know, masks, for example. I mean, I never wore one until all this happened, but I tell you, I kind of like not even getting a cold. So I wonder if there will be people who say, you know what, in the wintertime, I'm going to slap a mask on when I go into the grocery store. I mean, do you think certain behaviors will remain or change as we continue to live with this for the rest of our lives?
I do think that we've started to think about, you know, transmission of illnesses differently. And we've thought about that on a community level, but also a personal level. And so your question is one that I think that a lot of people are going to think harder about this. For me, for example, you know, as a physician, we haven't always worn masks for interactions with patients, even, you know, patients who would maybe just have a cold, we would just go and examine that patient. And when SARS-CoV-2 started circulating through and we started wearing masks for all encounters, we all started to think, well, that seems like that was a good thing that we probably should have done all along, right? Our dental colleagues do it. They've done it for decades because they're being exposed to mouth secretions and stuff day in and day out. And so I think in the medical community, there probably are going to be some permanent changes from this. From a personal level, I think it's going to be a very long time before I decide ever to fly on an airplane without a mask again, even if the FDA takes away its mask mandate. And that's just knowing what I know about viruses and transmission now. I mean, that's probably a difference that I'm going to have in my personal life. And you're right, during cold and flu season, going to the grocery store, man, putting on that mask, that may not be a bad idea. So what I would like to see happen, though, is that our society becomes gracious enough that if someone decides to wear a mask in that setting, then we just let them, right? Like, no big deal. Just let the person wear the mask if they want to wear a mask. And if we see that it becomes more normalized, like maybe other people will adopt this, because I think it certainly is a way that it might, you know, keep us all healthier in the future. You know, one of many things. I think we're going to learn a lot from this.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. Grace is a huge part of it. Before we go to break, I want to ask one more question. This comes from a Canyon County listener, and Dr. Pate, they ask, is there any data available as to whether Omicron can also cause long-haul COVID symptoms?
So there is some data. You know, the problem is, you know, people like Dr. Wyatt and I like to see a lot of data and repeat data and data in different settings before we make conclusions. And you just have to keep in mind, you know, as Dr. Wyatt was saying earlier, you know, Omicron really rose up really fast and is coming down very fast. So we really, and you talk about long haul. Well, you know, when would you make that call that somebody has long haul from their infection? Generally, we like to see people at least a month out from the infection before we would label them in that group. So we just really don't have a lot of time. It hadn't been that long since Omicron started. With that said, you know, we also wondered, you know, will children get MISC? And unfortunately, with those two disorders, it doesn't appear that you have to have severe disease to get either one of those conditions. So it does look like you still can get them even with Omicron. I think questions that we can't answer at this point, what's going to be the rate? What's going to be the risk? What's the relative risk? Are you at more risk of getting it after Delta than after Omicron or reversed? And those are questions we just don't have the answers to. The scary thing is that if, in fact, people are going to get long COVID at the same rate that we've seen it in the past with Omicron, then it is going to be scary because so many people got infected with Omicron.
Let's take another break if you have questions. Oh, go ahead, Dr. Wyatt. Yes.
No, that's okay. You can take a break. That's good.
No, go ahead. No,
I was just going to say on that note, there was just a study, though, that came out that showed that the risk of getting long haul is significantly higher in unvaccinated individuals. So following this forth over time, that even though if you're vaccinated and get COVID, you may experience symptoms such as significant fatigue, but the chance of that continuing to the point that you would develop long COVID symptom is significantly lower.
That is a
good point. Also, less likely for MISC if the child is vaccinated. Both of those came out.
Dr. Wyatt, Shelley Wright writes in saying, what makes something a strain, a variant, or a mutation of COVID-19? For example, could there be something that we initially think is a new variant, but it's actually not part of SARS-CoV-2, but a different coronavirus? Would that affect treatment or vaccine efficacy?
So Shelley, you bring up a good point. It's hard to keep all the lingo straight. So yeah. I'll try to simplify this as much as I can. So SARS-CoV is the strain. It's a type of coronavirus. That's the strain of the virus. This has never changed. This has been consistent from the beginning of the infection. So a mutation happens when there is a small change in the genetic material of the virus over time. A variant happens after enough mutations, it doesn't even have to be enough. It can be a single mutation can result in a variant. It could be multiple mutations that result in a variant. And so these are where our variants have come from, alpha, delta, omicron. These are different variants of the virus. So it's never going to be an issue that SARS-CoV-2 is going to evolve into a completely different coronavirus. That won't happen. But what can happen over time is it can continue to change to have new variants based on mutations that it picks up. And as those mutations occur, leading to new variants, there is risk that the current vaccines may lose efficacy if the targets of those vaccines are parts of the virus that's where the mutation has occurred. So.
Okay, that's good information, because you're right. It can be difficult to keep up with all of these terms. Dr. Pate, we got an email from the owner of a small retail business, and this owner says, all of my employees are vaccinated but have family members with COVID. Now, some of my employees are at high risk due to age or pre-existing conditions, and none can work from home. So do I let an employee who has a sick spouse come to work while their spouse is still symptomatic? If so, how do I keep the rest of my employees safe?
Well, you know, that's a tough one. And it would be helpful to have a little bit more information. First of all, the listener says that his workforce is vaccinated.
Yes.
But it wasn't clear to me whether they're boosted. You know, certainly they're going to be far more protected if they're boosted than if they just have had the two-shot series. The same thing happens is if you have somebody in your home, a family member who is infected, your chances of being infected are much less if you're boosted. And if you're boosted and you get infected, you're going to have lower infectious viral loads and for a shorter period of time. So the other information that would be helpful is that I don't know what kind of business this is and what kinds of precautions can be taken. I mean, if we're talking about a meatpacking plant where people have to stand next to each other and he's telling us that a lot of his workers are high risk, then of course, this is going to be very dangerous for those folks to come back quickly if they've got somebody infected at home. On the other hand, if the business is more of an office type setting where people can be in separate offices or down the hall, then, you know, those things are all going to make a difference. What I would say in general is just given the fact that a lot of these workers are high risk, I do think you want to try to protect your workers. And so certainly if you can keep those workers home for that first 5 days after somebody in the family has been infected, and then have them come back and they can wear a high quality mask, an N95, KN95, that kind of thing for all the time that they are in the building or in proximity with others, then that's going to be safer. But I think we'd have to come up with an individualized plan based on specifically understanding that person's business.
Okay, that is good to know. Dr. Wyatt, Lauren in Boise wrote in saying, I recently had COVID and spent 10 days in isolation. My husband is concerned that even though I have recovered, I still may be able to transmit the virus to others. So do I need to be concerned about this?
So we have to keep in mind there's multiple factors that may impact the duration of time someone might be contagious after a COVID-19 infection. And so I don't have all the information about this listener's scenario, but some mm-hmm. things that I take into consideration are how ill the person was, meaning like if they were in the hospital, they may end up being contagious a little longer. Was the person vaccinated and boosted? What's their underlying immune system status? But without having that information, I have to go on kind of based on the currently available data that we know. And there's been a lot of analysis around this from multiple countries have tried to better understand the transmission of SARS-CoV-2. And the consistent factor is that most people tend to be contagious 2 to 3 days before they develop symptoms. And usually their ability to spread the virus wanes after about 8 days after the onset of symptoms. So if you've completed, if your symptoms are resolved, you've completed your 10 days of isolation and you don't have any factors that might make you be contagious longer, you would be unlikely to still be contagious at that time.
Dr. Wyatt, a listener wrote in asking this, since the Omicron variant is less virulent than Delta, is the reduced threat of severe illness and death beneficial in the long run? Not that there is a silver lining to any variant, but is there an argument that Omicron's replacement of Delta in terms of infections could be a better outcome at this point?
So to answer the first part of this, I think it's important to understand that we are still analyzing data to fully understand the epidemiology and transmissibility of Omicron. It's new, right? We all have kind of speculations what we think about more contagious and moving forward, but we really don't understand what that fully looks like yet until we end up on the other side of the peak from that. So there'll still be some data to come in that regard. Preliminary data does suggest, though, that it causes less severe illness compared to Delta, but also hard to know because so many more people have already been vaccinated, too. And so if Omicron had come through our community before we'd had vaccines, it might be a very different outcome that we're experiencing. I was just in the hospital working last week, and it's still very striking that the very sick people in the hospital, critically ill in the intensive care unit, are vast majority unvaccinated. So even though we're saying that Omicron seems to be less severe, it is still causing severe illness in unvaccinated individuals. But if we're saying that Omicron is spreading quickly, that means that more people are going to be infected, both vaccinated and unvaccinated. And this may help our society transition to a point where we are now living with Omicron or living with SARS-CoV-2, moving to that endemic state that we have alluded to earlier. The good news is because most people have been vaccinated or once people have recovered, there's less likely to be fewer severe infections down the road unless we get new variants that might make that different. So I think because of this, yes, what Omicron is really doing is getting us to a point that it's either, affecting people who've been vaccinated with less severe illness or infecting unvaccinated, so we'll now have some degree of immunity after. So a large portion of our society is basically going to be either have natural immunity or vaccinated after this. But there's still going to be loopholes in that. And so any people who are remaining who haven't been infected or haven't been vaccinated are still at risk for severe illness, hospitalization, or even death from that. But to the point about, is this maybe what it's going to take to get us to the living with the virus? Yeah, this might be it. But I don't want to say that that's definitive because we don't know yet if we're going to move to another variant that might be different in how it spreads through society.
Dr. Pate, a listener wrote in, we'll call him Ned. He got an email from his anti-vaxxer sister. That's what he calls her. And he says his sister wrote this. COVID affects both vaccinated and unvaccinated, but why put an unknown substance in your body if you're going to catch the virus anyway? His sister continued saying a friend of hers said after two shots and a booster, he's got COVID and he's sicker than he's ever been. Now, her friend said he never got polio after his polio shot. He never got tetanus after a tetanus shot because those vaccines worked. So Ned wants to know, Dr. Pate, if he should believe his sister or the doctors on Idaho Matters about the COVID vaccine.
Well, I'll just give my disclaimer. I think highly of the doctors on Idaho Matters. So let me just start with that. I think what we're hearing from this listener's sister is common to other various streams of misinformation that we hear. First of all, we have to understand what does it mean that a vaccine works? Now, there are some vaccines that are developed with the intent of creating what we call sterilizing immunity, means that you're not going to get infected. That's not what these vaccines were designed for. And if you just listen to what Dr. Wyatt said a minute ago, if you look at the people in the hospital, they're almost all unvaccinated. And if you look at the vaccinated ones that are in a hospital, they're almost all immunocompromised. So, you know, I can't do it on radio because you can't see anything, but there's some dramatic charts that you can look at through various sources that just plot what has happened to hospitalizations and deaths since vaccinations have become available. And it is absolutely clear that people that are vaccinated are protected from severe disease, hospitalization, and death. So don't let those that are saying, well, it doesn't protect you from getting infected, make you conclude that the vaccines are not effective. That's not true. Second is that, you know, this comment about I'd rather trust, you know, the virus in my body than the vaccine in my body. Well, I can tell you, I won't speak for Dr. Wyatt, but I know she has spent a lot of time. I can tell you, I've spent countless hours looking at what happens to people that get vaccinated and what happens to people that get sick. Let me tell you, I don't want that virus in my body. The vaccine doesn't last in your body very long. The virus can cause significant problems for you long-term. We've talked about long COVID. We've talked about MISC. There's many more things, and we don't really even know everything. So I think that some people are going to regret thinking that they'd rather have a virus in their body than the vaccine. Anyway, I would not base my decision based on what his sister says. These vaccines are extremely safe. We've vaccinated hundreds of millions of people, more than we do of all the other vaccines combined, just about. And we don't see serious problems, but we are seeing lots of serious problems with infection. So please listen to the reliable medical experts.
Well, I want to thank both of you so much for your time, for your expertise today. As we continue to talk about COVID-19 and where we are with the pandemic, we have been talking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. And Dr. Cassie Wyatt has joined us for the first time today. She's an infectious disease physician with training in epidemiology. She works at Sawtooth Epidemiology and is a partner with St. Alphonsus. Once again, I want to thank both of you for your time, for your expertise, and for your wisdom and the facts about all of this as we continue to move through this pandemic. So thank you both so very much.
Thank you,
Gemma, and great to hear your voice, Cassie.
It's been a while. So.
And remember, our medical experts will be back next week. So if you have a COVID-19 question for our doctors, send us an email. You can do it today, and we will, of course, get to it next week. Our email address, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. Thank you so much for trusting us with these questions and for our medical experts being so gracious to come on as they do every week and answer your questions as we continue to move through this. So our thanks to our listeners. We appreciate you all so very much. My senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. Again, you got a question, a comment, or an idea? Send us that email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Wednesday. It looks like the snow's melted that showed up this morning. I hope you find some joy in your day, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.